Hi, how you doing? My name is Harry Brown. I'm a lecturer in the School of Media at Dublin Institute of Technology, who, along with AFRI and the Irish School of Ecumenics, have brought Alexander Coburn here to Dublin this week. We have the unusual circumstance of having a warm-up act for Alexander tonight, and it's in the form of a song from John Francis. Is John here at the moment?
This is an anti-war song, fresh from the States. Disappearing those Shenandoah pines. John Brown, you are alive and well. John Brown, you are alive and well. Some call you hero, others call you fool, but your firehouse still blazing in the hills. Wear it like a banner. Such indifference in the lap of luxury. There are those among us who still believe. Oh, say, can you see things are not as they seem? From sea to shining sea. Dr. King, I know you're listening. They can kill the dreamer, but they cannot kill dreaming. It was a great proud nation called the States. It was a great proud nation called the States. 100 years from now, they'll be thumbing through the page. The history books will tell about the States. Dr. King, I know you're listening. They can kill the dreamer, but they cannot kill the dream. It's Montgomery and Wounded Knee. Montgomery and Wounded Knee. It's Baghdad and D.C., Jerusalem, Tel Aviv. And the first thing I did right was the day I started this fight. Raise your fist, resist, and then be free.
Piece of music so steeped in American history and in American landscape and in American music in a way that Alexander Coburn, though he grew up here in Ireland, I think would completely empathize with.
Yeah.
There's little need for me to introduce Alexander Coburn. I presume if you're here, you probably know something about him. He's given us, many of us, a great deal of pleasure over the years. He is one of the most ruthless and scathing critics of his and indeed our opponents, and I think we all enjoy him for that. But we also enjoy his enjoyment of it. We enjoy the pleasure that he takes in the English language. We enjoy the pleasure that he takes in the good things of life. He would turn from writing about politics to writing about food to writing about music. And he's a man of genuine culture and someone who brings real joy into his work. Just on the way down here tonight, he was reminiscing about dancing with Miss Ireland in a nightclub in Nassau Street in 1957. And earlier, he was talking about writing leaders from the Irish Times when he was still a teenager, writing leading articles for the Irish Times and the terrible deadening effect it had on his prose for many decades to come. So, with no further ado, because he's who you're here to hear, and I give you Alexander Coburn.
Thank you, Harry, for those excessively generous words. Well, I guess it's Bush. Did he land? Yeah, is he making light conversation to the Queen? In the first state visit of American president since Woodrow Wilson, 1918, shows the decline in American civilization from Wilson to Bush. And Wilson wasn't so great, but Bush, my God. I'm going to do some UN bashing. But I thought, since I'm from the States, that maybe I'd preface it with a little tidings from the other side of the Atlantic. Like many left formations around the world, the American left is prone to pessimism. I mean, there's a lot to be pessimistic about, usually, but it's always rather slow to see the good news, because it's congenitally always telling people the bad news. And I've always been of the belief, as a journalist, that people like a little up. And it's not, you can't just... My father remembers when he was in New York, in Union Square one time, and he could hear a communist organizer trying to rally people to the communist standard. This is in the 30s. And the communist organizer said, "Brothers and sisters around the world, millions of communists are writhing in the dungeons of the oppressor. Millions more are suffering the vilest tortures for their beliefs. Join the Communist Party." And it seemed to, seemed to lack appeal, you know. In a way, now the news is pretty good. I mean, we saw the anti-war movement build up to one of the largest collective manifestations of solidarity against war in the history of the planet. I think it was the largest. And pretty much everything that the anti-war movement said turned out to be true. Uncannily accurate predictions. As opposed to the right wing, the neoconservatives around Bush, many of whom were liberals under Kennedy, who depicted an easy walk into Iraq, a quick settlement, the musical chairs in the Middle East rearranged to the satisfaction of the United States, maybe of Israel, trouble-free, a vastly increased U.S. presence in Central Asia, and the whole thing seemed a dream scenario. And now what do we have? We have what's going on. It's a staggering humiliation for U.S. imperial power. Of a major sort. You've got the whiff of panic in the air. You've got Bush's ratings down at 51, 49. And you've got emboldened resistance in the States. So that news is pretty good. But what is coming against the Bush, the politics of Bush? And this begins us to get into the theme about the UN. Because currently the leading candidate for the Democratic nomination in the United States is Howard Dean, former governor of Vermont. Now, Dean is commonly called anti-war. And if you want to get a sense of the depth of his commitment to peace, you really should go back and look at what Dean was saying in the spring, right about the time that the hot war began, the actual invasion of Iraq. And Dean was indeed saying, this should be done under the auspices of the UN. He didn't always say that. Sometimes he'd said if the UN didn't agree, then the US should go in anyway. He could turn on a dime one day to the next and say the one or the other. So you can say two things. You can say, well, Dean is a hypocrite. He's calling for the UN. Or then he's calling if the UN doesn't click its heels and say, go for it. He's going to say, the US should just go in with the UK and the coalition of the willing. Pretty scanty coalition it is. Or you can say, that's a very accurate resume, what the function of the UN actually is. That it's nothing much more than an after-sales service provider for the US. Now, historically, the left has always tended to click its heels when the word UN is mentioned. It's always counterposed to the arrogance of imperial power. You have the image of the UN as a body deliberating, voting, maybe offering a more pacific version and so forth. And that's deeply ingrained in liberals and leftists and people of progressive beliefs. In America, you can go from city to city and you'll have federal societies and these people, and they really are devoted, very devoted to the idea of the UN as a real alternative to US imperial power. But it is a rather unhistorical vision, and I think one that leads us very much astray if you don't really see what the actual history of the UN has been. And I speak as someone who, I went to Oxford in 1961, and the first speech I ever gave was attacking the UN for its role in subverting Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. And the most violent demonstration I think I ever went on was outside the Belgian embassy the night that the news came that Lumumba had been murdered, basically by the connivance of the Belgians and the US. And the UN had been very instrumental in that, in the downfall of Lumumba. So I myself instinctively rather don't see the UN in quite the benign terms that many do. But after all, when you look at what the circumstances of the founding of the UN were, they were not founded by, you know, benign federalists. The UN was coaxed and basically brokered into being by a triumphant United States that was seeing itself as inheriting the mantle of world power after World War II. First under Roosevelt and then under Truman. And you can read the discussions and you can see on the one hand that it was a very nice rhetorical setup that they said, here is a body that's going to contain all the countries of the world. Wonderful. At last, a global body. And it is going to be devoted to the cause of peace. And it's hard, you know, you can't go around denouncing peace. So you've got now worldwide and peace. So you've got two huge assets for the UN. But simultaneously, you've got correspondence with Roosevelt when he said the whole thing was going to be run by the US through the Security Council. And he said, and the people who, two powers objected, one was the Soviet Union under Stalin, the other was the UK under Churchill. And Roosevelt said, you know, we will have absolute control through the Security Council. And so it came to pass. So with the founding of the UN in 1945 San Francisco, you had on the one level the hopes of the world, very genuine hopes. My father covered it for the Daily Worker, actually, and can remember going across the states, and they ran special trains across the states, and people would walk up to the train, came out of the prairies, out of the plain states, and all the states across. People who'd fought, you know, knew that their husbands and sons had fought, and they'd go and touch the train. Now, there was real belief, just as there is still belief as to what the UN can do and what the UN could be. And then the trains, you know, their trains arrived in San Francisco, where the U.S. Secretary of State, the former head of U.S. Steel, Stettinius, was sitting in the Fairmont Hotel with the all the delegates from all of the countries around the, being bugged by the U.S. military regularly. All the transcripts of what they were saying was provided to Stettinius the following morning. And the whole thing was jimmied into what in reality was a totally U.S.-dominated institution. And simultaneously to that, what you had going on was the other U.S. security network to ensure its increasing global domination, which was the system of regional alliances. And the person who was very powerful at that U.N. founding convention was Nelson Rockefeller. And Nelson Rockefeller had come straight from Mexico, where he'd brokered the Treaty of Chapultepec, which was billed as the U.S. and Latin American nations protecting each other, but was in fact, like all these things always are, basically a security arrangement whereby the U.S. would continue to prop up brutal elites throughout the Americas. Nothing new. But that went on simultaneously to the founding of the U.N. So you can see which way the wind was blowing. And then after Roosevelt had died, Truman, who took over, and Dean Acheson, his Secretary of State, thought that the UN really was a bit chancy, even though they had absolute control through the Security Council, and they began to build up this alternative system of security alliances, CETO, CENTO, NATO, and so forth. And that was the conditions under which the UN came into being. Now, all through the decades that followed, there was always the hope, you know, that the UN would act as a countervailing balance to ever-increasing U.S. power. And for a time, it did seem to be happening. And there were people here, I'm sure, can remember, you know, hopeful things. Some of them, actually, boosted by the Foreign Minister of Ireland at the time, Aiken. The phrases like positive neutralism, the non-aligned groups. And that sense that the UN was producing an alternative global political culture, I think, really climaxed probably in the 70s with the idea of the New World Economic Order, whereby third world countries would have new arrangements where they wouldn't be looted of their basic commodities, where they get a decent price for their commodities, whether it was bauxite from Jamaica or whether it was timber or whether it was oil. And you would have a New World Information Order, whereby the dominance of the imperial powers in terms of information would be challenged. You would have various international treaties which would restore the balance between rich and poor, such as the Law of the Sea. And these were all ardently sought after, ardently debated, particularly in the UNCTAD, which is the Trade and Development Agency of the UN. And within a few years, it was all gone. Why was it all gone? Because that whole, those decades of a different idea of development of third world countries, where you, before neoliberalism arrived, where you would actually have some measure of state control, you would have third world countries with some measure of protection of their public assets. By the mid-70s and the early 80s, that was all swept away. And you had what we now call the beginning of the neoliberal era, where you talk about the triumph of the free markets. What is the triumph of the free market? Of course, it's surprising open a poor country, you know, looting its public assets. Let's say you take a Latin American country, you'd get all its hospitals, its telephone system, you name it, everything, and sell it off, usually to first world people who will, again, strip it of its assets, make a few bucks, and then move on. The classic example is Argentina, where Argentina did absolutely everything it was told to do. It hooked its currency to the dollar. It, you know, stripped everything out of the place. The place was bare. And it collapsed. The economics minister fled the country with the president. Newspapers in the United States, which had praised it, Argentina as the paradigm experiment in neoliberal discipline, all suddenly fell silent and began to look the other way. You know, huge food riots in Argentina. And that was it. And that was really the paradigm model of what neoliberal economics can do. And after all, what are the presiding institutions of that, which are institutions that are tied into the UN system, which, of course, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. And when you look back at it, the U.S., the people who contrived that system of global domination were not stupid people. I think the people now running U.S. foreign policy are stupid people. It's impossible to look at them and not come to that conclusion. I mean, you cannot look at someone like Rumsfeld and think this man is really a very, very stupid human being. And I think he's now daily appearing more and more so, and we won't even go on about the mental capacity of the President of the United States. But the architects back in 45, 50, had a pretty wide vision of it. They had the UN system, they had the real system, they had the General Assembly, where everyone said, this is great, this is the planetary debating chamber, where every nation can have its moment. But you simultaneously had this control through the Security Council, to which you didn't allow Germany, Japan, you excluded really any real power. The only country that ever really has ever had any veto in the Security Council is the United States of America. And that's that. The leadership of the US has never been under any illusion about this. But what has happened is that the left and the liberals have retained illusions about it and constantly paid rhetorical lip service to it. Because I think of two reasons. One, down the years there was not much else to hold on to. Particularly if you thought, whatever its ghastly faults were, that the Soviet Union did present during the Cold War some measure of countervailing power to the United States, some possible signpost to alternative economic systems, some protection and umbrella to countries like Cuba. You could still see the UN as a place where, a cockpit if you like, or a theater where all this could take place. And so loyalty across lifetimes has been built up to the idea of the UN. But I think it behooves us to say, well, what idea really is it? You know, you do get institutions which carry on long after vitality is drained out of them. Like the Roman Senate, I think it persisted far into the Byzantine Empire in some vestigial form, you know, having exciting debates, you know, maybe a mission to Dalmatia or something like that. You know, and the world, the history of the world is filled with these rotting carcasses, which are still around. And you can say, you can have a splendid adornment to our system, and then you see what is its real function. And I think if you look at really what happened in the 90s after the US, you know, after the Soviet Union had gone down, the Cold War had been won, and they began to redefine the idea of the UN as well of NATO as now imposing a different agenda. No longer lip service paid to national sovereignty, but now really the idea of military humanism. That if you didn't like the look of a regime for various reasons, you could then say it had no real national sovereignty in regard of its breaches of human rights. Send in the human rights organizations, write up a few reports, and then send in the paratroopers. Pretty neat little system. And that's how it evolved. Now, when you really see it most vividly with the role of the UN is with Iraq, where you can see the all the time the UN has, as I said before, been an after-sales service provider. If you look at the UNSCOM, the inspection system, which went from a Swede, Rolf Ekéus, to finally to Blix, you can see how this system really worked. Ekéus ran UNSCOM, and I'll give you an example of what went on. After 91 and Saddam's incredibly stupid invasion of Kuwait, maybe encouraged by the US in April Glaspie's famous statement, maybe not, it's all a little cloudy to me, he was told to disarm and remove his weapons of mass destruction, whose components, as we all know, were furnished by Germany and by the United States and so forth. And of course Saddam Hussein, I don't need to remind you, was installed originally as, you know, as a Ba'athist counterweight to what they saw as the real threat, which was the communists. In 1995, Kamal, who was Saddam's son-in-law and had been in control of all departments in Iraq, Saddam's Iraq, researching and trying to develop weapons of mass destruction, whether chemical, biological, or nuclear, fled Iraq, and went to Jordan and Amman, and where he was debriefed by the CIA, by SIS, the British Secret Service, and by UNSCOM, Ikeas, the Swede, and his team of inspectors. And actually, you can go and look it on the net. The briefing paper is actually up there, on the debrief memo is up on the net now. And he said, actually, Saddam Hussein was finally persuaded by the sanctions, also being administered by the UN, that, you know, he had to maybe not give up the distant dream of having a weapon of mass destruction, but certainly had to give up the reality of it and destroy all physical appurtenances of systems of weapons of mass destruction. Keep the blueprints. Think, you know, if we crank them up, we can, but they were all destroyed. He gave great detail about this, and he had military aides with him in Amman who gave even greater detail. Then he was lured back to Iraq and promptly shot by Saddam Hussein. The debrief by Ikeas was kept a deadly secret. He did not go forward saying, we now have some compelling evidence to show that actually there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It was all kept quiet until actually a pretty good journalist on Newsweek, actually earlier this year, called John Barry, unearthed the Ikeas memo and confronted Ikeas, who's now heading the Stockholm Peace Research Institute, where, you know, grazing peacefully and rich in retirement, after being a UN inspector. By the way, he became Swedish ambassador to Washington, D.C. He said, what gives? You know, what about this memo? Why don't you proclaim a great moment in the history of the development of peace? And Ikeas said, well, we didn't want to, we thought we'd get more out of the Iraqis if we didn't tell them we knew. And if you're curious about war fevers and their fermentation, you can go back to a February issue of Newsweek where he got his story in against the impassioned resistance of his editors. They're all being swept along by war fever, of course. And the story is there, under a headline which is misleading. It says Saddam's hunt for weapons of mass destruction. That was the headline. The story says that, according to the debrief by Kamal, they were all destroyed. So there you have a UN inspector conniving in a very successful way to conceal something that he, as a UN official, should have been publicly declaring. And if that's about as strong an example as you can find, apart from the involvement of the UN in the sanctions program. So what is the UN actually doing? Now, as we get nearer to the hot war, of course, the efforts to get the UN to give its benediction grew greater and greater. And the Security Council did resist. It didn't discommode the invasion of the US, the UK, and the coalition of the willing. In they went, with, of course, France, Russia, and Germany taking a critical stance, I think very much under the influence of the world peace movement, emboldened by that, which, of course, caused other important things, like Turkey refusing to let troops land in the north, and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, when things began to go bad after the hot war ended on May 1, when you would have thought that the UN would have redoubled its critical opinions about the performance of the US and the UK, what actually happened? You had Vieira de Mello, the Brazilian UN Special Ambassador to Baghdad, cobbling together the provisional government, a bunch of quislings, and thieves, headed by Chalabi, a noted thief, bank robber, imported them, where they're now proceeding to loot Iraqi national assets, and went back to the UN to proclaim the successful creation of this provisional body. Then went back to Baghdad, where he was blown up. You then had on October 16, suddenly, after people talking about the resistance in the UN, what did you have? You had the Security Council issuing its resolution, unanimously passed. And I'll read it to you. The Security Council welcomes the positive response of the international community to the establishment of the broadly representative Governing Council, supports the Governing Council's efforts to mobilize the people of Iraq, determines that the Governing Council and its ministers are the principal bodies of the Iraqi interim administration, without prejudice to its further evolution, embodies the sovereignty of the state of Iraq. It authorizes a multinational force under unified command to take all measures to contribute to the maintenance of security and stability in Iraq, and requests that the United States, on behalf of the multinational force, report to the Security Council on the efforts and progress of this force. Now, what more vivid and graphic evocation could you have of what the UN Security Council is all about? A rubber stamp for what the US wanted to do. So, to return to the domestic scene, you now have a bogus debate going on inside the United States, where an anti-war candidate is Howard Dean, who says the UN should have been involved. That's what passes for a real debate about war and peace in America. And people think it's a perfectly reasonable debate. The more you connive at something that isn't real, a bogus resistance, the more you deceive people about what the real forces in the world are. So, two things follow from this in my view. I think the left can certainly concede, you know, that the UN has been, maybe could be, a countervailing force, but not the way it's constituted. If you had maybe a couple of major nations in the world actually get out of the UN, say it's a useless body. The same way that some countries are saying the longer we remain under the sway of the IMF and the World Bank, the longer will we persist in a world and connive at the prolongation of a world where half the population of the planet lives on under a dollar a day. You know, countries like Malaysia and Brazil are actively entertaining that. They've seen for a pretty long time that the IMF and the World Bank are simply instruments for maintaining the very poorest countries in debt peonage and in basically keeping the whole world in an economic system administered under neoliberal principles by Washington. Why not transfer that idea of independence to the political plane? Or say that power has to go to the General Assembly. Of course, the US wouldn't put up with that for a minute, and neither would other advanced industrial powers, but at least you would have a genuine debate as opposed to a bogus debate. In the same way now that you have Powell saying, we want the UN involved. Oh, we do. We really do. We want them to sweep up. They've got good vacuum cleaners. They can just scour the offices out, make it all look nice. We'll have the blue helmet instead of the beige and buff one. What does that mean? It means nothing. So you then have to say, well, what is the solution? Well, they should just get out. They should get out. And all assets, all Iraqi national assets that have been in the process of being stolen since May 1 under the privatization by the Governing Council, we're already asking for kickbacks of 25 cents on a barrel of oil for where they're going to allocate the contracts, say no, that all has to go. The Iraqi people are quite capable of, maybe they're not, maybe they are, we hope they are, of appointing provisional government, pending elections, drawing up proper electoral lists, having an election, retrieving its national assets, and establishing a political career. Do we really want a UN-supervised governing council backed by US military force, which is the sanction, basically trying to set up a situation kindred to the rule of Saddam? We don't want that. I think we face, in the period to come, some fairly ruthless questions about what significance, what measure of challenge to the rule that was installed in 45, which has now ended up with the triumph of the US as the global power, supervising planetary arrangements, how do you get beyond that? And you will not get beyond it if you maintain the illusions of what the UN is. So I just think we have to abandon this parrot call for the UN to take over. That is my fundamental theme. I think you has to be, and again I speak coming from America, again a series of realism about what the alternatives are, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party at the moment. It is very hard to meet someone on the liberal left in America who does not say, you know, any Democrat will be better than George Bush. Maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't. Wesley Clark, insane former head of NATO, you know, where a British officer, Jackson, had to say, I do not wish to start the Third World War in your orders, after Wesley Clark told him to attack the Russian units that were going into Pristina in the middle 90s. I mean, he's a real rug chewer. You want him? It's very hard to persuade. I was talking to Nader on the phone the other day. I said, Ralph, if you got stick in 2000 for running, I said, baby, you're up to 2004, they'll be lynching you in effigy the whole way across the United States. And he sounded quite pleased by that, actually. you know, he's been in the wind and the rain. And he said, you know, there has to be a continuing tradition of resistance. There has to be a third-party challenge. You can never accept the terms of a totally bogus political debate, where you're offered an alternative that doesn't really exist. If you go back, I wrote a book with my co-editor of Counterpunch, Jeffrey Sinclair, on Al Gore in 2000, called Al Gore, a User's Manual. I've got roughly 8,000 copies. I can let you have them for a dime on the dollar. In there, if you turn into this very great book, you will find us quoting Al Gore as saying exactly what those scenarios were that were put up to George Bush by the neocons. He was saying, you know, Bush, Saddam had to go. The war plans were being pronounced as much on the Democratic side as they were on the Republican side. Naturally, you know, there are some differences between the two parties and their two performances. But actually, there's just been a really good book done on Clintonomics by Bob Polin, a very good left economist, which actually says, you know, that working people and poor people were worse off at the end of the Clinton boom. And in terms of real long-term protections, enhancing the ability of trade unions to defend working people, you know, real institutions of defense against the predatory nature of late neoliberal capitalism, nothing, worse than nothing. The difference isn't that great. You cannot maintain yourself in these long-term illusions. The good news is, I think that, and I'll end maybe this portion of the remarks on this thing, that the resistance, and I'm sure, I know it's true here, but that on many levels has been pretty good. People talk about, you know, the emerging fascist state in America. I don't think it's got to that, frankly. It just hasn't. People love to say, I hail the smell of fascism. Well, maybe a whiff coming around the corner, perhaps. But the resistance to what they wanted in the Patriot Act has been pretty strong. And remember, a lot of the portions of the Patriot Act, the stuff that Bill Clinton couldn't get through in 1996 in the Counterterrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. A lot of the Justice Department had a wish list. And they got some of it through and some of it they didn't. Came the attack on the trade towers, and they, ooh, we'll get that one off the shelf, and they shoved it in again. But such things as the TIPS program, where everybody in America was meant to turn into a snitch, you know, and you'd look out the window and you'd see your, you know, your neighbor reading some newspaper, and you're meant to call up the FBI and say that he's reading a newspaper, it's got a red banner and I don't like the look of it. And people said, come on, you know. I mean, a few cranks. I mean, life is full of snitches, but it didn't really increase. Then libraries, you know, the idea was that, you know, the FBI could go to a library and see what you've been reading. You know, the librarians resisted that, and it finally backed off. You had, and again, it's another point, a lot of people on the right, who are pretty nutty in a lot of ways, on the issue of the Bill of Rights, sometimes they're not bad. You had people like Dick Armey of Texas and Bob Barr of Georgia, who are ripely right-wing Congress people, actually saying they didn't like the erosion of the Bill of Rights, and started campaigning for the American Civil Liberties Union. It doesn't mean that if someone set off a bomb in Washington, D.C. tomorrow, an Al-Qaeda type thing, it would all start again. I mean, emergencies produce savage legislation time after time. But I have to say that in the wake of 2001, the resistance has been pretty great. much greater than might have been anticipated. So the sky is not dark totally. So under the banner of realism about what we can do, realism about what the world is really about, and acknowledgement that the prime resistance really to the global imperium is occurring in the alleyways of Fallujah as we speak, I'll leave the next questions to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alexander Coburn. I'm sure there will be some questions, and we will have plenty of time for questions from the audience before we're kicked out of here tonight. I'll just say now, because Alexander Coburn would never be so bold as to plug a book from up here, that there's a new book available from Counterpunch. He's got one copy of it here, The Politics of Anti-Semitism, which is a collection of great articles by Counterpunch contributors on the question of Israel and of the tag of anti-Semitism that is often thrown at critics of Zionism and of the State of Israel. And you can find that on the Counterpunch website, www.